Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. As you may know, the goal of Central Coast Voices is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. We basically want to work with you to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community, how yesterday's choices in some cases, and that may be a topic today, are affecting decisions that are affecting other people today, and the ramifications of change or lack of change on society. As you probably know, Action for Healthy Communities is a project of the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation, and Action for Healthy Communities is the sponsor of this program, and we are an arm of Action for Healthy Communities trying to spread information about the nature of the Central Coast and living here. Action for Healthy Communities has a program called Vital Signs. It's a study done every 3 years. It's available for review or download in its entirety at actionslo.org. You'll gain a lot of insights into everything from homeless issues, water issues, economic issues in the community, and we'd like to share that with you when you would like to look at it. It is available. There's no charge for it. Anyone can download it or view it online at actionslo.org. Today we're going to deal with a topic that I would have to kind of preface with saying we would like it to be a topic that we don't have to discuss, because we'd like it to be a topic when that everybody knows how to best deal with it and just move forward. But that doesn't seem to be the case these days. We're going to talk about where we stand after a recent measles outbreak in the state of California that's affected both the state of California and the country. And the recent disease outbreaks that we've had, along with sometimes misdirected concerns over the safety and effectiveness of vaccinations, has really come back to haunt us a little bit. It's a discussion that in a lot of ways, those of us of my age think it was a discussion and a topic that went away when we all understood what vaccines did for us as a society. And today I'm joined by Dr. Penny Borenstein, who's the public health officer of the County of San Luis Obispo. And I'm also joined by a microbiologist and associate professor at Cal Poly. And we're going to look at this topic as we can, because there's a lot of parts to it that are really difficult to address. Anyway, and I'm sorry, I skipped over this. Pat, pronounce your last name. I'm sorry. At this point, I'm tongue-tied a little bit. So,
Fido Piastas,
and I apologize for that. For some reason, I just could not get it out there. Pat is a doctor of microbiology and an associate professor at Cal Poly, and as I said, Penny Borenstein is the county health officer. This is a topic we've talked about before. But I would classify it as a crisis. Penny, I think we want to start with you. Do you, as a health officer, classify this as a crisis?
Well, I think, Fred, that you characterized it really well in saying this feels to me as a topic that we shouldn't have to deal with. It goes in cycles as to how often we have to deal with it. So today, it's not a crisis, but it was just a couple of months ago, and it will be again if we cannot get to a place where we have at least near universal, if not universal, acceptance of the risk-benefit of vaccines. So, I, like you, feel that we ought to be able to just speak truth about the science and have our community understand that and make appropriate choices, but unfortunately that's not the case for everyone.
Yeah. I don't recall this being a topic of crisis, and I would refer to the crisis part as the part of the community that feels like vaccinations are not important or counterproductive or a number of reasons we'll get into. And I thought about it before we set the program up about maybe staying away from part of what started this crisis. But I think reality is, from some of the questions we've heard people pose about this, that we need to discuss it. A number of years ago, a doctor in England did a study that has since been found flawed, that implied that vaccines were causing certain illnesses. And I would rather, I don't know, if you feel it's okay to even talk about the illness he implied, we can go there. But I think I'm wondering if we needed to stay away from that. But the study was alarming to a lot of people and created this big uproar about, oh, we just have to stop vaccinating children. And it was made very clear rather quickly that the study was indeed bogus. I don't know medically if there's a term other than bogus we'd use for it. Bogus is the only word I can think of that I can use on the air.
Yeah, I think more accurately in falsified data. It's okay. More than bogus. It was more than, misleading. It was, to my mind, somewhat criminal. And I would probably bring Pat into the conversation as a microbiologist and researcher, what kind of bells that raises for him. It brings the whole industry of microbiology research into question in a way that is stunning.
Yeah, anytime you have a publication where there's more authors than individuals in the study group, I tend to raise an eyebrow. And even before I looked at the science, it was pretty clear that Wakefield was already in the process of applying for permits or whatever, or patents rather, on his own version of a vaccine to sort of compete with MMR. So there's already this weird conflict of interest. So even before you get into the science, there's that. And But that was those are the big issues that I had right off the bat. And the science itself, obviously, when you're working in a study group of 12 individuals, you got 13 authors, and many of the patients in the study group were sort of handpicked by a lawyer who had some outstanding litigation against an MMR producer. There was a lot of red flags.
The lead physician in this study has since had his medical license revoked based upon this particular issue.
Yes. It was that serious.
That doesn't happen
so
often.
So to speak truth, I personally shout from the rafters the specifics of this. MMR, just for those who might not know, is measles, mumps, rubella, is one of many vaccinations that we use. And the disease that it was touted to cause was autism. And I take that very personally because I have a family member that with that condition. So to give parents a false hope as to causality is just criminal in my mind.
And you start a rumor, and it takes nothing to get a rumor started, and it takes years and millions of dollars to quash it after it comes forward. I think that's part of what we've seen go on with this. Let me remind folks, this is a program we'd like you to participate in. It's a discussion we'd like you to be part to. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We would like you to be part of the discussion. I would encourage you, if you have questions or concerns on this topic that you'd like to discuss with our guests, that you call in early, because we oftentimes discover we have calls towards the end of the program that we do not have time to cover, and I want to make sure everybody's concerns get heard. I'm in my mid-60s. Okay, I was raised in a generation where I knew people who had polio. There were family friends, there were people who were a few years older than I was that had polio and had remnants of polio that affected their lives. My mother's best friend was in a wheelchair because of polio. My wife's mother had partial loss of the use of one arm based upon polio. We were raised in a generation where people understood that there had been some awful things that we could control or eradicate with vaccines. It seems now, as I read some comments from some people, that we have a couple of generations removed from that, where an awful lot of people now feel, oh, we're alarmed about some medical problem that's no big deal. they kind of treat it the same way as, oh, I really don't need a flu shot because a friend of mine said he got the flu after he got a flu shot last year, and the flu won't kill me, so I'll just be fine this year. That seems to be what we're addressing a lot of, is how do we educate people, besides having programs like this, about the fact that we are dealing with real illnesses that have a real history of really hurting people?
Yeah, that's the $64 million question, is how do you get a whole new generation who does not have direct experience with how deadly many of the diseases are that we can prevent, are and would be again and continue to be in much of the world. I mean, if I could fly everybody to some villages halfway around the world and they could see that polio is still reaping havoc in places. Malaria is one of the number one childhood killer. I mean, I'm sorry, not malaria, measles, one of the number one killers of children in the world. Not just that they get a rash and fever for a few days, they die from it. So I don't know, in the absence of that direct connection, how it is very much a challenge to get that idea across, that this isn't a bunch of money-making pharmacy, you know, folks who develop these products to inject children with, you know, umpteen doses when you hear all kinds of things. Natural immunity is better, and the combination of all of these vaccines is harmful. It's a risk-benefit analysis that needs to take place in the backdrop of science.
We've got some calls, and we've got, of course, a lot of questions to talk about, but I want to make sure our callers don't wait too long. Nicole, are you with us there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead. What are your comments or your questions?
You know, I have a comment, and I've heard this many times, talking about this one study that was debunked, showing a causality between the vaccinations and autism. And a lot of people point to this one study. However, I'm looking at right now a list of over 90 research papers supporting a vaccine autism causation. The first one on the list was actually by a researcher with the CDC, Thomas Burr Straton, in 1999. And the results say specifically that there was an elevated risk of autism, which was at 7.6. So an elevated risk of 7.6. The next one talks about the hepatitis B vaccination and autism, and it just goes on and on. And I'm happy to forward this to you if this is research that you haven't seen.
Okay, let me back up. Is it research? Are you looking at actual studies, or are you looking at a synopsis from the internet?
I'm looking at a synopsis, but there are links to the individual studies in them.
Okay.
I'm happy to send that to you if you haven't had a chance to review.
No, I've reviewed those papers.
Okay. Actually, Pat has said he's reviewed those papers and he has comments for you.
I've reviewed a lot of those, and they're not from peer-reviewed publications. And the ones the peer-reviewed publications that I do defer to are, for example, the large study from Denmark with a 500,000 subjects in which there was absolutely no connection. If you look at the Yokohama study from Japan, they completely refute any of those studies that I believe that you're referring to. The Yokohama study was particularly compelling because the individuals, these Japanese children, had not even received the MMR vaccine from 1993. And beyond that, and so and what they saw was that the rate of autism went crazy actually from 1993 on, even though the MMR vaccine had been stopped. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of individuals that were in this study, and autism rates were skyrocketing despite the fact that nobody had received these vaccines. And so the Australian meta-analysis that took a variety of large-scale epidemiological studies, the same sort of analysis that was done to show the link between cigarette smoking and cancer. Once again, this Australian study with 1.2 million individuals represented in the study showed absolutely no link between MMR and autism. These are the studies that I defer to, not sort of cherry-pick things by one or two people whose motives are questioned. And again, these are many of the studies that you're referring to, because I read this stuff all the time, and they're not peer-reviewed. And again, I question the motives. Like I, just like I brought up before with Wakefield, Dr. Wakefield had initiated a patent for his own measles vaccine to compete with MMR. So that's something that we have to always look at, is what are the motivations of these individuals?
I think we could go head-to-head till the cows come home on studies. And I get to the point with a lot of people, if you're firmly entrenched in your belief that that vaccines cause harm, I come to a point where I say, oh, well, we're going to have to agree to disagree. And as arrogant as it may sound, however, the answers in the scientific community are abundantly clear that there is no linkage. So, you know, just in a more general way, Pat was saying we could pull out studies and numbers and what have you, but at the end of the day, either people choose to respect credible sources of scientific knowledge, CDC, National Immunization, National Institutes of Health, American Academy of Pediatrics, and on and on and on, or you don't, and you have your reasons for doubting those credible sources. And I'm going to say, you know, you are entitled to your opinion. I'm not going to spend all day trying to convince you otherwise, but the scientific community, you know, overwhelmingly shares the same perspective that vaccines do not cause autism.
Yeah, Nicole, I don't want to just dismiss you from the phone. So Pat mentioned the concept of peer-reviewed studies. Do you understand the difference between those?
You know what? Absolutely. I'm a scientist, and the first study I'm looking at is from the CDC. I'm looking at other studies that are published in various journals, the Journal of Toxicology, the Journal of Biomedical Science. And, you know, my thought is when we look at the motive, people, as a mother, I'm just trying to keep my children safe. That's my primary motive, looking at the risks and benefits of vaccination. However, the pharmaceutical industry has a tremendous motivation get these vaccinations.
Nicole, I want to interrupt you for a second. I want to interrupt you for a second. Do you know anybody who's ever had polio?
I haven't, and I'm not talking about the polio vaccine. I'm not opposed to vaccination. I am opposed to this blanket, all these vaccinations are safe, and my infant should get vaccinated for hepatitis B, which is a sexually transmitted disease, even though hepatitis B has been implicated in hundreds, if not thousands, of injuries by the United States' own reporting system.
Excellent. Nicole, I guess where I'm going to leave it with you today is if you can get me a local scientist that would like to come on the air and talk about this, we'll gladly have a program.
Wonderful. Hopefully one of them will call you because there are many of us.
Okay,
out there.
Great.
So
thank you very much for taking my time.
While you're getting the next caller queued up, I just want to say to Nicole and others, when I say that at some point we just have to end the conversation, I mean that with all genuineness, that I don't take it personally. I absolutely believe that parents who come to these conclusions are doing so in the best interest of their children.
Yeah. All right. We have Charlie. Are you there, Charlie?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, Charlie Blair. I'm a retired physician. I grew up in the polio era, and actually, I was one of the first people to take the oral vaccine when I was in med school. Anyway, I refer you to a book that I think I mentioned. Deadly Choices: How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All, written by Paul Offit, who is an infectious disease consultant. War on Science is Under Siege, Casualties Are Mounting. Victims aren't professors or researchers, they're children. This was published in 2011. They talk about, you know, pharma, vaccines are not particularly profitable for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, you raise a good point.
Absolutely correct.
Okay.
In fact, many vaccines have gone off the market because they don't have a profit margin, and some of the bodies that I've mentioned, like American Academy of Pediatrics, Family Practitioner, CDC, et cetera, have had to cut deals with pharmaceuticals and beg them to reinvest in creating these vaccines because they actually do come at at a loss in some cases.
Charlie, thank you for your call.
This is I really recommend Deadly Choices by Paul Offit. People should read that and then think about the issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay. See, we have Park, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, my family has a history of autoimmune disorders, and the most serious of which did precipitate right after the vaccines. That was my sister-in-law when she was like two. She had her vaccinations, and, you know, that's obviously hard to make it, but her hair fell out. She lost all of her pigment. And then also in the family, like real severe reactions to bee stings and so forth. So for our child, we thought we were going to ride herd immunity just because seems to make more sense for us. And then I just like, you know, all this waving, flag waving and, you know, arm waving about, you know, this catastrophe of opting out of vaccinations, like, seems to be overblown when, like, isn't California, like, the opt-out rate, like, 5%? And, you know, if herd immunity is not achieved until you get, you know, like, 98%, are you ever going to get herd immunity? Those are kind of my questions.
You bring up a good question because we have herd immunity as a topic to talk about today. So why don't we first define herd immunity, and you can...
The classic definition would be making sure that the most people possible are immunized or immune to a particular disease to serve as a barrier for those who can't be immunized, like very small children, for example, are not immunized, very small children, newborns, for example. And I'm referring to MMR because oftentimes we allow the mother's antibodies to pass to the baby, and when those antibodies wear off, then the baby is eligible for MMR. But the idea is to create as many individuals in the population who are immune to a particular disease to prevent barriers from the disease ever establishing or taking hold. So that's a classic definition of herd immunity.
And the caller, Park, brings up the point of, you know, at what proportion of our community needs to be immunized in order to achieve that level of herd immunity. And pretty much all of the diseases that are covered by vaccines have theoretical models that have been created to say, you know, in the case of MMR, it's around 92% for the measles protection. In other cases, it's as high as 95% that you need. In no case have I seen it as high as 98%. But we do have places in the community, not statewide, not nationally, but there are, for example, Nevada County has a rate of immunization compliance with school law of only, 26% of their population. 26% of children in Nevada County are not vaccinated in compliance with the state law. And in our county, until this past year, and we can talk about legislation that has already occurred and what may be coming, our county was 9% unimmunized. That was a rate that came up over the course of a decade from 2% a decade earlier. So each year, we have seen more and more families opting out. Now, this past year, for the first time in 10 years, we saw that turn a corner, and we only had 5.6% of parents opting for the personal belief exemption. And I feel that, you know, again, the evidence isn't there solidly, but the one thing that changed in that year was a piece of legislation that required families to be educated by a physician or other healthcare practitioner about the risk-benefit analysis of vaccines before they sign a piece of paper that say I'm against this. Previously, it was very easy if a family had a disorganized life and showed up on the first day of school and needed to get their child to start school. A secretary could pass a piece of paper across the desk at the, you know, school office and say, here, if you sign this, it's not a problem. And that's what we saw happening with a lot of folks. So the rate basically of people opting for that personal belief exemption was cut in half in our county in 1 year's time just by virtue of requiring people to be informed about their choice.
Were you able to track by school or by municipality where that was mostly going on? Because I'm curious. There may have been a vector source of the misinformation, just sign this and no one will care, that was going on.
We do have information every year about the individual PBEs called personal belief exemption rate by school, including public and private schools, and definitely there's a vast difference across schools. Private schools tend to have much higher rates of use of the PBE than do our public schools, and also it does differ somewhat by geography.
The case that brought this about and put it back in the media this year was the measles outbreak at Disneyland. There's been some conflicting information that I've seen as to they allegedly knew who the actual carrier was, but that did not get well defined. But they were able to look at the age range of most of the people who were then infected. And I think a lot of those were not people who had opted out of vaccination. They were children who were too young to have the vaccination yet, or too young for the vaccination if they had it to take effect. And that's certainly a layman's view of what the news media was saying. What is your medical and scientific experience been with that?
So with this particular outbreak, I wish I had the numbers in front of me. A very high proportion were unvaccinated. Being able to break
83% or something.
Being able to break it down, there was definitely a mix of those who were old enough to have been vaccinated, but who themselves or their families had opted out, as well as those who could not be vaccinated by virtue of being too young or having a medical condition which prevented them from receiving certain vaccines.
Did that give the medical and scientific community any I would think it would give you some alarming information to work with, which would imply that there are more people out there unvaccinated than you realize.
It seems like it, absolutely, that there are more people out there opting out, which is interesting because more people opting out, but rates of autism continue to skyrocket, and that's what I said previously. And to speak to what Nicole's question previously, nobody's up here saying that vaccines are 100% safe and that everybody should run out and grab them. These are things that have to be carefully analyzed with your doctor. We know that there's neomycin, antibiotics, things like that are included in vaccines that people will have an allergic reaction to, and by no means should everybody be getting these things because they can't. Some people are allergic to eggs or gelatin or whatever. So there is that important thing that not everybody can be vaccinated.
Okay. I want to remind you that this is Central Coast Voices, and we'd like you to be part of the voices that we're sharing. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We're talking today about the implications of both vaccines being used and in a lot of cases not being used or being opted out of by some people, and how they affect the medical well-being of our community. So we'd like you to be part of that discussion. And let's see, Tara, are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead, please. You're on the air.
So I had a question for the guests. I'm concerned about the slippery slope of requiring a medical intervention, which vaccines are, and it's been determined that they're inherently unsafe. So I'm just wondering, where would your guests draw the line? Because a lot of adults in the community are not fully vaccinated, and so do they advocate vaccinating all adults? Because if you're talking about herd immunity, it doesn't make sense just to require it for children. And so I'm just concerned about things like everyone needs to be fully vaccinated to get a driver's license or to get a passport or to get health insurance, something like that. So I'm just wondering, where do you draw the line when we're talking about medical procedures that have an inherent risk?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So I mentioned earlier school immunization law. Every state in the nation has school immunization laws. And they are vetted very carefully. It usually takes years, many years, to add a new immunization to a state requirement So new vaccines come on the market not that frequently, but there's a big difference between recommended vaccines and those that are required for participation in a school system. And I would liken that to any other United States law or other nations that have laws where risk-benefit analysis is done in a very measured, extended way before a decision is made to impose something on a broad swath of the community, or in some cases, entire community. So let me break down a couple of parts of your question. The fact that adults do not have mandatory vaccinations in the vast majority of cases. There are some exceptions for healthcare workers, which are becoming more prominent, is because most adults who, you know, we use that 1957, there's evidence that if you were born before 1957, there is herd immunity in that adult population because they were around these diseases so frequently that even if they don't remember as babies or their parents don't remember, if we did immunity testing on the vast majority, on everyone born in that era, they would be found to be immune, and therefore it's unnecessary to vaccinate. Since that time, most of these vaccines started to come into play in the 1960s, so not long after that cutoff point. So presumably, again, if the vast majority have been immunized, then we've covered the entire population, either through natural immunity or through vaccination. But making that decision about what needs to be a mandatory vaccination is a public health decision. It's not a medical decision. And so I liken it to seatbelt decisions and helmet laws and, you know, where on every one of those topics there's controversy and understandably going to always be differing opinions across the spectrum of American thought as to when does something become an individual right? When does the individual right outweigh the community benefit? And as a public health practitioner, I'm obviously in the field of advocating for the best, most good for the highest number of people. And it gets complicated when you're talking about children because they do not get to make their own informed decisions. And there are times when families are just not making a decision because their lives are such that they're not reading the internet, they're not reading studies, they're not reading the blogs, they just aren't taking care of their children. And so it is a societal norm for us to pass laws that protect the entire population, and that's how I view the set of immunization laws.
Okay, I think, Tara, thank you very much for your call.
Say one more thing, though.
Go
that
ahead.
There was a law that went into effect in January of 2014 that required any parent with an opt-out for school to have a consultation with their doctor. So it is not true that the parents don't just know. Any parent who has an opt-out right now for personal belief has had to consult with their doctor, get it signed off. So they're making a conscious decision to not vaccinate their child, usually for very good reasons. And there's also a federal bill that was introduced May 1st, H.R. 2232, that people can look up, that will require the full schedule for childhood vaccines, including HPV and the flu shot and things like that, that will withhold grant funding from the states unless children are vaccinated. So I know a lot of people are comfortable with the 10 vaccines that are required now, but a lot of people might not be comfortable with getting a yearly flu shot for their kid or HPV or something like that. And so my question again was, you know, where do you draw the line, both for children and adults? And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you. Bye.
Where do we draw the line? And is there a line? Do we even know how to draw the line?
Yes.
Okay.
I would say to that mandatory vaccinations come into play when there is the possibility of community transmission of an organism. So HPV, which is the human papillomavirus, is sexually transmitted and is not a requirement. I is not at this point anywhere, and I don't foresee it becoming so. It prevents cancer in adult women, and it prevents genital warts in both men and women, or teenagers and adults. So, but where you've got aerosolized transmission, so by virtue of just sitting in a classroom, you can become ill with one of these, that's when we talk about community benefit.
We've got a lot of calls, so I don't want to keep them waiting too long. Sorry. Is it Kayla?
Kyla.
Okay, Kyla, you're on the air. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this topic to the forefront because it is very important, especially with the introduction of Senate Bill 277 being voted at, in the Assembly coming up soon. So I do appreciate that and hope that you'll talk a little bit more about that. I do have some questions about studies that have been done on specific ingredients. I've done a lot of research on this, and I can't actually find very much information, so maybe you can point me in the right direction on studies that have been done on aluminum, which is an ingredient in a lot of these vaccines, and we all know that aluminum is a neurotoxin and that it's been linked to breast cancer as well as a lot of other, like Alzheimer's and things like that. So I'm just wondering why and if there have been any studies regarding that.
Yeah. Can we address one at a time?
Sure.
Okay, Pat will address this one first.
There are a lot of studies, but particularly with aluminum, for example, which is a super abundant metal, and if you do an analysis of breast milk, for example, from a swath of females, you'll find some in there. You'll find aluminum everywhere. And so it's just like MSG, for example. MSG's in some vaccines, and people panic like crazy about MSG. But if you take the ripest, sweetest, most organic tomato and make a soup out of it and just put a pinch of sea salt in it, it's going to be a soup full of MSG. This stuff is out there, and there's not a lot we can do. So it's difficult to say that you know, it's such a bad thing. That formaldehyde, for example, that sounds scary, right? But the cells of our body produce formaldehyde. It's a single carbon molecule. We use it in metabolism naturally. And so I'm not saying that, yay, let's go bathe in formaldehyde, but I'm saying that the amount of formaldehyde in a vaccine pales in comparison to the amount of natural formaldehyde in a pear, for example. So what do? Do you stop eating pears because there's formaldehyde naturally occurring in pears, or natural MSG in tomatoes? So this stuff is out there. And so without me even citing, you know, actual papers and stuff like that, I could just say that it's all around us. And it's very difficult to say that this microgram amount of even mercury, you know, the ethyl form of mercury, that's been extensively studied. And even in little babies, which, you know, who the heck wants the concept of mercury in your baby is a little disconcerting, obviously. But it's pretty well shown that the ethyl form of mercury is rapidly removed from the body, the human body. In just days. It's not something that lingers. It's not like the methyl form of mercury that may build up in the tissue and last for a long time and cause the neurological problems. So I'm a parent, and I analyze this stuff ridiculously, and I've come to the conclusion that these things are, you know, they're out there, they're everywhere, and in the dosages that we get them in vaccines, they're simply not a problem. There's just simply no evidence for any of these things, even the scary aluminum, which is in our deodorants and pancake mix and all these places that we get it. It just so happens that we've happened to focus on the vaccines or the things that seem scariest to us. But so that's what I would say to that. But like I said, the research has been done. It is out there.
You're saying that there are no risks involved with these specific ingredients, the aluminum, the formaldehyde, the thimerosal.
You can never say no risk, but the risks are infinitesimally small. And as I said previously, they're in equivalent or smaller concentrations than a lot of natural sources that you probably consume every day. And so that's the important take-home message. So.
Okay, so that brings me to my next question. For the female doctor, she mentioned earlier that there were no that vaccines were not harmful, but I just wanted to bring up the National Vaccine Inquiry Claim Board that has already paid out $1 billion in injury claims, and I just want to point out that it's a federal government compensation plan that the pharmaceuticals are not actually liable for any kind of harm that their vaccines might cause on a person who is vaccinated. So what is your thoughts on
that?
Thank
you.
$1 million.
Thank you for holding my feet to the fire on this. No, you're absolutely right. The National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was started about 20 years ago. It is so if I said there is no harm, again, back to what Pat said, nothing is 100%. So I deal in the world of population-based risk as a public health physician. There is always going to be some risk to some small number of people from anything that we do in the medical world. We get mammographies, we're exposed to radiation. We may have a metal implant after a broken leg, so we make a choice between having an allergic reaction to that metal versus being able to walk again. We make these decisions every day, you know, personally and at a systems level. So if I did say there is no risk of vaccines, then I withdraw that comment. But even at $1 billion, the rates of injury from vaccines are on the order of 1 in 1 million. And it varies, again, by which individual vaccine. But that's generally the kind of risks that we're talking about. And in some cases, the balance goes to if it can't be disproved that the vaccine may have been the antecedent of some kind of harm, then sometimes claims are paid out. And the reason that the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, is held harmless is because we were losing vaccines from the market rapidly because of the lawsuits and payouts, even when there wasn't, you know, smoking gun cause and effect of the injuries. So the federal government created this program for exactly that reason.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. I'm sorry. Anastasia, are you there?
Yes,
okay.
I'm here.
Thanks for your patience.
Oh, no problem. So we as a family vaccinate, but we vaccinate on an alternative schedule that was discussed and decided on with our pediatrician. And I'm going to, again, bring it back to SB 277 because my concern is that it's also requiring Hep B, which we opt out of, and the chickenpox vaccine. Now, I know that a lot of people want to say, oh, the science is clear everywhere. But all you need to do is get on. There's a website for Europe where you can compare vaccine schedules between different developed European nations. And all of their vaccine schedules vary. So they all have different things. And the one thing I found in common is that they only vaccinate for Hep B in specific groups, meaning at-risk groups. My children are not at risk for Hep B. And I'm being told now, if SB 277 goes through, that they must be vaccinated for it, along with the fact that I can't do my alternative schedule anymore. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are, considering the fact that we have all of these developed European nations doing different schedules, and we're telling people, you have to do the schedule that we've decided is right for you.
So this is Penny. There's a lot of there is some variation in schedules based on a range of studies as to what is the most protective. So even within our own U.S. recommendation, CDC has an arm called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. It's comprised of, I don't know, a couple of dozen experts in the vaccine arena who monthly decide what is going to go into a formal national recommendation. And they look at all the studies. And sometimes it's not totally clear, so they may give a range. Hepatitis B is a good example. The first dose is recommended at birth, but it can be birth to 1 month of age. The second dose is recommended a month later, and the third dose is recommended with a minimum interval of 4 months from the first dose, and but no less than 6 months across the three doses. Very complicated, and I don't mean to diss my fellow pediatricians, but many of them can't keep it all straight because it's very complex. And yet, by the time you get to school entry, which is what these laws are about, and I know there's child care regulations as well. So, but just putting that aside for a moment, because we require children to go to school in this country. We don't require them to go to a child care center. That's another whole conversation. But it's by the time children enter school that they have to have certain vaccinations. And that is universal amongst developed countries. And so whether it's the MMR at 12 months or 15 months or 18 months really becomes irrelevant by the time of school entry. Now, as to Hep B vaccination, admittedly, that is a tough one because it is true that the average newborn baby is not at risk, and yet we recommend that they get it at birth. And that was after decades of trying other means of getting children before they became at risk to be vaccinated. So a two-year-old is not at risk, we hope. It's not universally so, at risk from a sexually transmitted transmission. But a 15-year-old may be, and maybe not your kid, but some 15-year-olds. And so, again, it's back to protecting children from either transmission that they are subject to right now or will be at some point in their young lives. And so I forgot where I was heading with that in particular. But, yeah, it's a risk-benefit analysis. Oh, yeah, with the hepatitis B, I was very intimately involved with that. In 1991, the first ACIP, American Committee on Immunization Practices, came out with the first recommendation, which was aimed just at high-risk individuals. So people from certain countries where hepatitis B is very endemic, people with drug users, you know, highly promiscuous in the day when we use that terminology, you know, high-risk groups. And that did nothing to lower the rates of hepatitis B infection in our country. And it wasn't until 1995 when that recommendation was changed to have universal vaccination that now we have the lowest rates ever of hepatitis B infection in our country.
Okay. Anastasia, did that address your concern?
No, she didn't at all, because I was talking about European countries who aren't giving Hep B at all unless you're at risk. And also the fact that there are other countries recalling vaccines constantly, and we aren't. The other problem I have that you did not acknowledge is that those advisory boards for the CDC often have vaccine makers on them, and that is a complete conflict of interest.
Okay.
Anastasia,
I have to guess, based upon the answer you just got and your response to it, I have to tell you, I believe you're not going to be happy with any answer you get from anybody.
I said European countries are not giving Hep B unless you're in an at-risk group at all.
Okay.
No one's getting it.
Okay. Pat, go ahead.
Anyway, I approached this the same way when my little one was born. And I'm a microbiologist, and I'm like, wait a minute, you know, Dr. Coriel, who's a local pediatrician, really, does my little guy need a Hep B shot? And he just said very simply, he might, you know, 20 years from now be exposed in some way, and getting it now is just a way to protect the individual who likely will not get protected somewhere down the road. And so get it taken care of now, the individual, just like Penny just said, the individual, you know, may never have to be worried about it, but getting it now takes it out of the way and takes that risk out of their life. So it is a worthwhile risk. There's no evidence that these things are dangerous, that particular shot is dangerous at the level that doesn't make it worth the risk.
So my problem is you taking away my rights.
Actually, I want to remind you, I need to jump in here for a second. Nobody in this room wants to take away your rights. Absolutely. There are state legislators who have a bill out there. And we'll try and get somebody on who's from the state legislature to address this issue. I don't think that the bill was written by anybody in this room.
Community transmission. Hep B, she said, and that's why she said we don't need to worry about HPV vaccine being mandated. Well, why is Hep B being mandated if you can't sit next to someone and get it?
Go ahead.
Legislation is imperfect. What did I've heard it's like making sausage.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things go into it, and on the other end, it comes out as imperfect. So the fact that some European countries don't have the same rigor in requirements, that's not just true of vaccination. That's true of lots of laws in European countries. You know, we have a society that for the most part tolerates, not universally so obviously, but tolerates regulation for the purposes of protecting our young and those who can't make decisions for themselves. Okay. And I guess, you know, in that may be some imperfect decisions, but.
And I thank you for the call. Okay. Rick, you're on the phone. And I'm actually on the air. Sorry about that. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Okay, yeah. I'm 76, and when I was a kid, we all came down with measles, things like whooping cough, chicken pox, primarily. There weren't vaccinations for anything, really, when I was a little kid. And when I got older, they came up with the diphtheria vaccination. But nobody considered these childhood diseases as being a cause for, I can't remember the term you guys used, but they didn't consider this like a super threat to society or anything. And it's been discovered that having those illnesses as a child gives you a much stronger immune system, that unless you actually have those diseases wherein you incur a high temperature for a period of time, your immune system doesn't fully develop. And I've heard some authoritative discussions on that subject, and I haven't heard anything that seemed to counter that argument. And I wonder if you guys could address that.
Well, I'll certainly let Pat address that part. But in terms of the medical that it was no big deal. That is true for the majority of people who came down with the measles or varicella, chicken pox, et cetera. There were, you know, it was very common to have parties and get your kid exposed early and get it out of the way. But what people don't realize, as recently as when did the varicella vaccine, chicken pox came on the market in somewhere mid-90s, 100 children a year died from chicken pox. So even though you may not know who one of those were, for that family, that's catastrophic.
And it's not just I think people always put it that in that disease, a death, you know, morbidity category as a measure of why it's necessary. But you have to look at the total disease burden as well. You know, all the time spent in the hospital and the burden on the hospital staffs and our healthcare infrastructure, those are real issues. You know, 2.6 million cases of measles a year prior to the measles vaccine coming out. You know, tens of thousands of kids that have life or death, you know, encephalitis and diseases like that they pull through, and so they don't show up on any death toll. But why would you want that? Why would you want your kid to be near death with whooping cough, something that can easily be treated? I had a friend of mine, his brother, who's totally anti-vaccines. His kids were on their literally deathbed with whooping cough, and he's like, "Well, they pulled through." But why would you want that? Why would you even want to deal with that when we have these safe and effective vaccines that can remove the disease burden from society in general?
Actually, Pat, I think you probably summarized a good portion of what this struggle is all about. There are people who believe that if it doesn't affect their child, it's no big deal. And Penny's comments about the number of people who've died from things that we would think of as simple, easily surmountable medical conditions has been a big factor.
Yeah, there's no question vaccines are the victim of their own success. And that's the biggest travesty that we've got so far is that they've been so successful. You know, something like smallpox that killed maybe, 300 to 500 million people in just the 20th century alone, gone. And now everybody's like, smallpox? And Jimmy Kimmel, I think it was Jimmy Kimmel, who said everybody's more afraid of gluten than they are smallpox. And that's just a travesty.
Yeah. Actually, we're down to the last few minutes. Penny, I think this can be frustrating for you folks, and I appreciate you taking the calls that we've taken. What would you like to make sure that people understand if they don't understand yet?
Well, like I said earlier, and every single caller that we had today was in the camp of thinking that laws are taking away individual rights, that we're not looking at all the research that's out there, that, we who work in the field of immunology or immunizations or public health are just simply not getting it. And at the end of the day, there is going to be a small proportion of our population that feels that way. They were in evidence today, and I do not believe that any one of them had anything but the best interest of their children, of their families at heart. And again, I come back to saying, I know that this probably will sound arrogant, but I think that they're just misinformed about the overwhelming stat. You know, there's lots of things in science that we don't know yet. There's lots of things. You know, is fiber in today or out? Is there, But this to me is there is overwhelming evidence that though, yes, vaccines can be harmful in some rare cases, but the risk-benefit ratio is so abundantly clear that I wish I could convince every family to make that same choice based on the evidence at hand.
Yeah. I don't have any medical skills. And a lot of people probably think that's a very good idea that I don't have any medical skills. But I have to add this, and that is I'm amazed that people believe just because they read it on the internet that it's absolutely verifiable, reliable fact. And that frustrates me a lot. I thank both of you for being here today. This has been Central Coast Voices. I'm glad you've shared with us your voice. This is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo. We want to thank them for their support and their efforts. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be your host, and she'll be speaking with Dr. Walker Correa, and she's a leader in the field of perinatal mental health, and she has written and researched mental health issues for people in a perinatal and neonatal environment. And her book, Transformed by Postpartum Depression, Women's Stories of Trauma and Growth, will be the topic of conversation next week, and we're glad that they're going to be able to have that discussion. Central Coast Voices is a product and a project of Action for Healthy Communities, as I told you. It is underwritten by Joan Gellert Sargent, and we thank her for her support. Your input can be given to us at voices@kcbx.org, or you can call 543-2323. I thank my guests today, Pat Fido Piastas, and I think that was reasonably close, and I'm sorry that I've butchered
That's
your
fine.
Name, Pat. I'm glad you have a simple first name. Thank you. And Dr. Penny Bornstein, our county health officer, and I thank you very much. This has been a lively topic. I hope people keep thinking about it and paying attention. We don't always make the right decisions, but at least we're thinking about things that are good for our children. This has been Central Coast Voices. Please stick around for This American Life. Next, this is your host, Fred Monroe.